Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up to date on the latest FinTech news. Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast, where we'll be talking about Square's efforts to become a bank, the Supreme Court decision in India limiting crypto efforts, Tencent's troubles in China, and the latest issues around Brexit. With me today is Monica.
Hey, John.
And Steve.
Hello, everyone.
So there's a lot going on, but first a few highlights. The Treasury Department is expected to release some rules on fintech oversight, specifically focused on non-banks and the multiple fintech types. They're trying to work within the existing rules in order to not create all new regulatory structures around fintech. So everyone's interested in seeing what kind of rules they're going to come out with. And
it's good work for the lobbyists.
And provide plenty of employment in Washington, D.C., which is always a good thing. The Bancor token platform has been hacked and has lost $13.5 million in cryptocurrencies. This is the same Bancor token platform that raised $153 million in an ICO last year.
So they've got the cash to make their losers whole?
Yes, you can look at it on the bright side. They did not lose more than 90% of what they had raised earlier.
It's a good metric. It's a great metric.
Yeah. It's on how you view things. FINRA has asked their member firms to provide information on their cryptocurrency efforts. This is seems like a part of the overall regulatory buildup from all of the regulatory firms to get a better handle on cryptocurrencies and their effect on the economy and the financial system. So this is just one more step, and hopefully on providing clarity and unity among the regulators on how they're going to handle cryptocurrencies.
Clarity and unity amongst regulators. You are an optimist at heart, John.
It's all in how you phrase things, Monica. So our first headline story for this episode is the amount that fintechs have contributed to the personal loan industry. Fintechs were only 1% of personal loans as of 2010, but now, at least as of 2017, they're up to 36% of total personal loans. And this is in a really fast-growing market. So they have been, as well as providing a greater supply, they seem to be doing a great job of marketing their services and maybe finding more niches and people that were underserved by the traditional banking system.
I wonder on that, do they make any distinction between secured and unsecured loans?
Yes. Personal loans are by their nature unsecured.
Unsecured loans,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, you know, and for some of these, you're looking at interest rates that are very much on par with what you'd get for a cash advance from a credit card. So it's not necessarily a great product to be the recipient of, but lots of people have a need for them. And obviously, fintech firms are really filling a piece in that market.
Yeah, these can easily go into plus 20% interest rate loans. Yeah. And they've been growing quickly. They were up 18% in the first quarter, up to $120 billion in the U.S.
Massive numbers. And it's funny that this happened even in light of a lot of the major P2P players sort of stumbling in the market, like a LendingClub and Prosper sort of contracting in earnest, being acquired at a valuation below where it was raising money. So it's interesting that there's a lot of growth in terms of personal loans being made, but the companies themselves seem to be sort of struggling. But
LendingClub loan activity was up 20% in the first quarter to $2.1 billion.
Even amid or other troubles with the CEO being ousted and their share price tanking and all that?
Hopefully that
people
means
people who need a personal
recover.
Loan, do they care? I mean, I look at this as like the high-tech version of a payday lender.
I think for customers to basically see this as a way to get a very convenient loan, not a well-priced loan.
Well put.
Yeah, not necessarily. And you see the rush towards this by the big players. So you see players like Goldman Sachs coming in with their Marcus product. SunTrust Bank has Lightstream, and other large players are preparing their entry. Since they've had to contract out of autos or second mortgages that have starting to cause them problems.
Insurance.
Delinquencies have gone up, losses have gone up, and this is another way for them to expand their lending activity.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me in this article is that they talk about consumers preferring these unsecured personal loans to tapping into a home equity line because of kind of their emotional hangover related to the Great Recession.
Yeah, I thought that was funny too.
And I thought that was so interesting because in almost all circumstances, if you already have a home equity line, you are going to have a much better rate and
much
better payment terms than you would with an unsecured personal loan. So I feel like we still have a lot of ways to go in terms of educating our mass American consumer.
Right. Well, this huge growth up to $120 billion, these high interest rates, new players coming in, this is all reminiscent of similar bubbles and lending problems that we've had before. And this is at the same time that interest rates are going up. So this means that maybe losses will be going up, and there's so much more lending in an increasingly high rate environment.
I wonder whether there's a difference in the charge-off rates for the fintech players versus the traditional banks, because they always tout sort of their awesome
their sophistication,
their exactly
AI models.
Yeah, exactly. We'll just throw ML at it, and it'll be an awesome product. Nobody will default. So I wonder whether the default rates are higher or lower for fintech players.
Well, what kind of data would they have in terms of the underwriting process that a major bank wouldn't have?
I think they have access to non-traditional data, so they can look at things like your LinkedIn profile and other things, other points
you
provide them.
Your Facebook likes.
Your Facebook likes, sure. I think they, in the case of SoFi, they look at where you went to school, what you're studying.
So is that almost a form of like regulatory arbitrage, that traditional lenders aren't allowed to do that, but these insurgents are? That doesn't seem like something that's probably going to last forever.
That's a great question, again, a great callback to John's initial point about sort of the coming regulatory framework for fintechs, mm-hmm. whether the new rules coming out will affect this, and we'll see sort of more parity in terms of the lenders and how they approach customers.
Yeah,
I don't know if traditional banks are restricted from using other parameters. Is that true?
They are. They cannot use non-traditional data.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, you can use things like Facebook or LinkedIn or even things other than what's in a uniform application that other banks have to use.
Oh, for non-discriminatory purposes.
Correct.
So if you give somebody a lower credit profile because they're followers of the Kardashians,
as they should,
click on every one of their Instagram posts.
Or a lower rate because they went to your alma mater.
Yeah.
Doesn't really sit right, does it?
You don't know my alma mater, do you?
Kind of hurts. Kind of hurts.
Yeah.
I'm not in a position to offer you a loan.
Yeah. Well, those are some interesting points. And I think that leads us right into our story about Square, which has withdrawn its application to become a deposit-taking bank, but it will be refiling. They said that there's just some procedural issues that they've been having, but they're ready to refile again. And this is part of this, what I see as this kind of convergence between the traditional and non-traditional banking spaces, where you've seen all these individual niche players expanding further and further out to provide all the products that their customers need. SoFi applied to be a bank, for a bank charter last year, but had to withdraw after some sexual abuse allegations from their CEO and his removal.
As one does.
Yeah, bye-bye, Mike Cagney. So they may be put on indefinite hold, but Square will be coming back, and they're no small player. Their market cap is around $25 billion. They've been expanding in all sorts of different financial areas with Square Cash. In this case, they're applying for the bank charter in order to serve small business loans, which they've been doing with their partner bank. And again, another characteristic feature of these fintech firms growing into the bank space is partnering up with the banks. And now they're moving into becoming banks themselves.
But I wonder from Square's perspective, what's the value of actually becoming a bank and having to go through all the regulations and be sort of under that framework as opposed to just operating as a fintech and kind of being in the Wild West?
It's wallet share.
wallet share.
Right? I mean, if you think about 20 years ago, if you were a small business firm, you needed a pretty good relationship with a local bank mm-hmm. who was going to work with you for your payroll, was going to work with you for your credit card processing, was going to work
treasury management, maybe.
Exactly, for everything you needed. And now you're looking at, you know, you might be a small business, you might be in kind of a sole proprietor, and do you even really need a traditional bank account anymore? Maybe you just need Square or one of their competitors. Also, I feel a little bit sorry for these partner banks. You know, there's the phrase, you got to dance with the one who brung ya. And I think that Square is not going to be dancing with the one who brung them for long.
Yep, I think that's one of the reasons that saying is going out. maybe it doesn't apply anymore. So Square Financial Services, Inc., will be coming to a neighborhood near you, to a mobile phone near you, actually.
Phone near you, absolutely. Mm. Keep an eye out for that.
Yeah. And they aren't the only ones. Varo Money in January raised $45 million to acquire their bank charter. So, like, to your point, Monica, these aren't cheap things to do. They it's a lot of regulatory overhead, a lot of bureaucracy,
yeah. mm-hmm.
a huge amount of compliance. And we saw this with the banking law revisions, trying to push that up just to the larger banks to give the smaller players an even playing field, to not have that huge overhang.
Yes, but isn't banking a good business to be in? When times are good, when times are bad, banking finds a way.
Yeah, I think you could say that the top 7-8 banks probably make over $10 billion a year in profit. So, and banks like Wells Fargo, JP Morgan are closer to $20 billion plus. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of money there.
Mm-hmm. It's a huge market.
That's why you become a bank. That's right. Where the money is.
Square wants a little bit of that.
Yeah. So, into our international phase of the show.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to share a little bit of information about some of the latest regulatory shenanigans happening in India. So this is something that's very interesting because we don't really have this situation thus far happening in any other country, but India's top court banned their lenders from dealing with cryptocurrencies. This applies to banks, financial institutions, and other regulated institutions within India, and they may not deal with virtual currencies. What's interesting is the reason, the justification that they've used is that India's laws include one that requires that coins be made of metal or exist in physical form and be stamped by the government.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
So how do they transfer electronic funds?
Hey,
or
yeah.
at least there has to be some basis.
Well,
or could they get around that by printing some bitcoins?
I would imagine that they're saying, this
yeah.
is a callback to one of our earlier episodes, that a virtual form of a physical currency is just a different petal on the money flower.
Right.
But it still represents that same fundamental currency that exists in physical form. So that's the basis of the ruling. Where this puts us is we've had the court have its say, but India's finance ministry hasn't weighed in on this. And the fact of the matter is that some of the volatility in these crypto markets isn't necessarily pushing the regulators and the courts to see these in as favorable a light as crypto fans might want them to. But this is something that we will absolutely be keeping an eye on. There's no other country that I'm aware of that's in this exact space. So we are looking at already a different kind of fork in the crypto world, a regulatory fork.
A regulatory fork. I love that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. The central bank was the one initiating this ban. But it's interesting to see that the finance ministry still has some, still keeping an open mind on creating some regulations and reintroducing. Hopefully that will happen.
Well, I have, as somebody who is a bit of a crypto doubter, a crypto bear, if you will.
Crypto skeptic,
that's the better term. I have always felt that central banks and regulators are going to come for their cut. So people who envision this nirvana where they're never going to have to pay taxes on their crypto gains and they're going to be able to have all of these anonymous transactions for the new Silk Road, I've always thought that was pretty pretty overhyped because regulators and central banks just don't play that way. And ultimately, most of us, if you want to be at all law-abiding, you're gonna have to play by the rules of your home country.
Right. Well, maybe that's what will bring it back, because if people are doing it anyway, because you can get internet, you know, satellite internet, mm-hmm. and get around the system, and then they're not getting their cut, maybe that's what brings back the regulation and an openness to including it in their system if they're losing out.
Never forget, they got Al Capone on income tax evasion.
That's right.
That's a good point, yeah. I also wonder, it seems like this rule applies to large FIs, but I wonder whether smaller players can actually still transact in cryptocurrencies and sort of bypass the whole framework.
Right, wasn't it lending institutions?
Mm-hmm. There was only lending institutions.
So you can focus your business the right way so that it will still pass.
The Bloomberg article that I'm referencing here actually stated banks, financial institutions, and other regulated institutions. So I think it has a lot to do with whether you are regulated by the central bank.
Much broader than.
Yeah. So it's not just banks.
It's not just banks, yeah.
Well, I saw that the European Parliament had recommended that cryptocurrencies be regulated and not banned. And maybe mm-hmm. it's just for that reason, so they can keep a lid and keep some say in what's going on.
I wonder if India didn't already have this very specific law around kind of physical form stamped by the government. I wonder if the ruling would have come down that way without that particular law in place, because I think the EU approach makes significantly more sense and takes into account kind of the realities of technological change and humanity in a way that India's current ruling maybe doesn't.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if things changed, because the cryptocurrency prices have been volatile, and we've seen the regulations be volatile as well, maybe reflecting that a little bit with a changing understanding of this new technology. So, India's not the only one having troubles around their new fintech and all the potential around them.
No, now I'm going to move to a story around the other big player on the Asian continent, what's going on in China. So Tencent, and for those of you who may not be familiar with Tencent, it is an absolutely gargantuan company in China. They are really kind of embedded in almost every element of an average Chinese person's life. And it includes, Tencent's offerings include WeChat, which is something like the equivalent of Facebook plus Twitter, neither of which actually are currently operating in China right now. So Tencent is ubiquitous, and they have over 1 billion users. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that under Chinese law, Tencent is actually responsible for any illegal content that's found on its newsfeed and on its other platforms.
That's fascinating.
Yes. And of course, you know, the Chinese regime has a very different structure, perhaps, than what we're used to in the U.S. And under these laws, content that endangers, quote, national honor and interests, or
honor, that's quite something to
yes.
Keep it nice and narrow there. Yeah.
Keep it nice and narrow.
Yeah, and I should clarify that WeChat is used to pay for everything in China.
It's all QR codes, right?
Yeah, right. It's much more sophisticated than a lot of things that we have here in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. No cards.
A big competitor with Alipay in China. So these two guys have been battling it out. So you see this everywhere. Places will either take Alipay or WeChat, or try to take both, but it's very competitive there with payments.
Their CEOs actually have the same last name, which is interesting.
Ma?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah.
They're brothers, actually.
No.
That would be hilarious.
Edit.
No, I kind of like that.
So under these laws, content that is against national honor and interests, or that undermines national unity, and yes, those are very vaguely defined terms, that content is punishable. And Tencent has actually already twice been penalized under this law since it took effect last year. So now we have this where Tencent is really coming under fire in terms of the content that its users are putting in the system. And you also have a wide belief across China that WeChat monitors communications, which WeChat says that it doesn't, but most Chinese tend to believe that it does.
Yeah, I've heard that they get a knock on the door if they've even thought they've made a private message to someone directly, and they still get contacted.
That's exactly right. Mm. So you have kind of this tension that WeChat and Tencent has between its regulators and perhaps its overseers in terms of the Chinese government, as well as its users. So Tencent has a real dance to do, and I think this will be an interesting element to watch. One of the most interesting tidbits to me in this article, if you choose to read it, is Tencent is just finishing up a beautiful, amazing new headquarters in Shenzhen. A shiny, shiny new...
gleaming new headquarters.
Correct.
Two towers, right?
Yes, and they were deliberating where to put the executive suite. They originally wanted to put it kind of right in the hub of things, like almost like, you know, the Star Trek bridge,
right,
where Captain Kirk would be there to be accessible for anything that would
an
happen.
An open area,
very visible to a big chunk of employees. And then they realized that they have members of the Communist Party and regulators and very senior placed visitors from the Chinese government so frequently that it would actually perhaps inhibit employees. So they decided to, as one often does, tuck the executives off in a corner suite with its own elevator and own entrance.
Of course, on a high floor, away from the plebes. Makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll see what happens here. Tencent's already been fined a couple of times. I'm certain that they can probably weather the fines for a good long while, but it seems like it's an uncomfortable place to be.
It's interesting how we see this sort of very involved way in which the government of China sort of affects its fintech players. I know a few weeks ago there's an episode of John Oliver on HBO where he was talking about how both WeChat and Weibo banned the word panda from the platforms.
I saw that. It was hilarious.
Hilarious, yeah, because apparently they people in China tend to equate Xi Jinping to a panda.
So now was it Winnie the Pooh?
It was Winnie the Pooh, that's right. It wasn't a panda.
It was Winnie the Pooh.
It was Winnie the Pooh. Yeah. But it seems like they have a lot of control over what goes on in on this platform.
How dare you compare me to a Western bear.
Right.
Maybe a panda would have been okay.
Maybe a panda would have been fine, yeah.
I mean, it's been a long time since I dipped into the Winnie the Pooh books, but maybe there's a physical resemblance, but there seems to be no temperamental resemblance between Winnie the Pooh and Jinping.
Yeah. I haven't seen Winnie the Pooh jail any dissenters lately. That's true.
Right.
Great. Speaking of Winnie, let's go to the land of Winnie the Pooh, actually, and Brexit.
Absolutely. So there's a couple of news reports came out this week. So as you may know, we're recording this on July 9th, and there's been some political fallout in the UK around the Brexit vote. So as of today, Monday, July 9th, Boris Johnson resigned from Theresa May's cabinet over what he saw as sort of as a soft Brexit plot in the UK, and now we can actually start to see the ramifications of Brexit on the financial space. So both Citibank and JP Morgan announced last week that they're moving some of their staff from the city over the channel into Paris now. So I think there's a lot of concern about what Brexit will mean for financial markets and for financial players in the UK, and now they're sort of moving to an EU country. I know that for a few months there was some discussion about whether the new hub could be Ireland or maybe Amsterdam, but it seems like now Paris is getting some traction in that space there.
Europe has done such a great job with developing new fintech and new ideas. I wonder if this will just lend into that, build into that more.
I wonder, I mean, London is, of course, sort of the capital of fintech in Europe, but I wonder what Brexit will do to that. I think that because of the regulatory aspects of new fintech players, so they're not as subject to those rules of the best big banks, you may not see that same outflow of companies from London to Paris as you see of the big banks sort of shifting employees.
I'm doubtful, because at the end of the day, the deeper you get into financial services, the more regulated it is. And the regulations vary by the jurisdiction, and it's typically typically best to be based where you're servicing people. You need to have good relationships with your regulators. You need to get the appropriate licenses and charters. I'm experiencing a lot of schadenfreude when it comes to the latest developments in Brexit. And Boris Johnson has no business negotiating anything in terms of keeping Britain on a hearty and hale economic path. He's a fool. You should definitely take that out.
He got fool's hair for sure.
His awesome hair is the best part about him.
Yeah. And his initials are even BJ. I don't know.
But actually, in all seriousness, one of the things that I think is very interesting is Boris Johnson has resigned, as has David Davis. And what you were seeing is some of the most hardcore proponents of a hard Brexit are leaving the government. And I think what that will actually end up doing is empowering the people who want more of a soft Brexit.
The Remain slash leave people.
Or
people
sort of reluctant on leavers,
right?
Right. And certainly for Britain's economic health, I think that is to the best. You know, it does not serve Britain very well, in my opinion, not to have tariff-free access to the EU.
Absolutely. Just imagine if you're English and you have to go, say, on vacation or holiday somewhere else, and may have to get a visa, may have to pay a fee. That's just a lot of burden to place on your citizens because you want to do some potentially fraught political moves there.
Don't they like having, I don't know, Spanish oranges?
Yeah, I don't know. There's a
French
way out at this point, right?
German cars.
There's no alternative, yeah?
There is not, yeah.
All right, and now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the story behind it. I'll start with $11 billion.
It's a big number.
That is a big number, isn't it?
I take it.
I don't know. I'm a little skeptical because according to a report from Juniper Research, that's how much that banks are expected to save by using chatbots. About 2.5 billion customer service hours are expected to be saved by chatbots in the future. In the near future, this is by 2023. And by the end of 2018, banks are expected to save up to $6 billion a year already. And this is banks around the world. So when you take all the banks in the world, I guess it does make a little more, it does seem a little bit more possible. So a good example of that is Credit Mutuel in France, which is working with IBM in order to use AI to help them process the up to 350,000 emails that they receive every day. When you look at those numbers, it does seem like an area where you could save a lot of money from people having to do this manually.
That is a massive amount of emails.
Who is emailing their bank?
Thank you for your great deposit skills the other day.
I gotta tell you, the last time I did, it was when I was getting a mortgage, and I would have been peeved to have been dealing with a chatbot in that process. I wanted a human.
You need high
maybe
touch
you'll get
for
a human.
Mortgage. It's a high volume, high cost transaction.
So initially, they're working on evaluating and categorizing the emails into where they need to go, and then dividing it into automated smart responses to whatever the query or comment is, and then the remainder will go to individual people.
That's pretty interesting. This is slightly off topic, but I heard a podcast recently where they were talking about the expansion of Alexa into France and how the intricacies of the French language present some challenges to actually having a voice assistant, because it's not as rules-based as English. So there's a lot of ways to put in words, and you kind of have to get the accent right. So I wonder how...
Quel dommage,
absolutely. It's actually pretty interesting in terms of how they will train these chatbots to respond to French customers' questions about their bank accounts or whatever service they do.
Yeah, along with AI, there's voice assistants that we've seen before with B of A using Erica. Capital One uses an AI called Eno, and Bank of Montreal has one called Bolt.
Bolt?
Bolt. So it sounds a little aggressive for a friendly customer service AI. But there's a lot of these efforts out there to replace all of these manually personal kind of customer interactions.
Yes, I do hope that they really get these to work at a quality level, because otherwise it is a terrible customer experience.
So
you are
only
reaching out to your bank when you need something.
Absolutely.
You're not calling the bank to chat.
With a chat bot, then get an offer response, and they have to go to the branch or call. That's just an additional cost. So this may be...
I think my worry is that this will make banks more like cable companies.
Better, you mean?
JP Morgan, meet Comcast.
For our next final bites?
I'll share mine. So this is a big bite as well. Not $11 billion, but $760 million. And that is the total value. No, I'm sorry. That is the minimum value of cryptocurrency that's been stolen from exchanges in the first 6 months of 2018.
$750 million.
$760 million.
At least, so, that we know about.
Yeah, so an organization named CipherTrace has provided this estimate, and they do describe it as a floor value. This amount is more than three times the amount that was stolen off crypto exchanges in all of 2017. So this is a rapidly growing business. And apparently, just the sheer number of crypto coins that are constantly coming on the market and the loose ID verification practices that a lot of different wallets and exchanges have are really tempting for a new class of criminal who is coming for your crypto.
The crypto criminal. Like it. It's a new job category.
Yeah, yeah. A growing, fast-growing job.
Fast-growing job category.
As we get closer and closer to full employment.
Yeah. You have to find ways to, other ways to make your money. Great. So for my final bite, I have a number that actually fits with yours because it's sort of the lower number. It's a much smaller number. My number is 150. That is the total number of employees that Goldman Sachs is hiring in the UK as they begin to deploy Marcus.
Mm-hmm. What? Can't they use the same regulations that they have in Europe?
If only Brexit hadn't happened, that would be the case. But no, they're going to hire 150 new employees to oversee, handle, launch, and market Marcus in the UK.
Wow, nice way to tie in our stories, by the way.
Absolutely.
Marcus is growing.
Marcus is coming for you. Wow. 20%.
Marcus
interest.
Is coming for my deposits.
Yeah, absolutely are.
Well, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. And remember to hit the subscribe button. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Bye, everyone.